You be you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. With bombs bursting over Afghanistan, the United States is pushing ahead with its war on terrorism. But unlike other wars, this one may not come with a silver lining for an already ailing economy. How will we pay for this war? And what are the American people willing to sacrifice? That's the topic we're exploring this hour. But first, the FBI and Centers for Disease Control continue to investigate two known cases of anthrax in Boca Raton, Florida. One man has died, and traces of anthrax have been found in another co-worker. Matthew Messelson, a professor of biology at Harvard University, joins us to talk about the disease and the recent outbreak. Good evening, Professor Messelson.
Good evening.
We are hearing that this outbreak is extremely suspicious, that it looks like a deliberate plant of anthrax. What are the red flags?
Well, first of all, that inhalation anthrax is very rare in the United States. There hasn't been a case for more than two decades. Second, that Florida is not a place that has reported animal anthrax for a long time. Those two things put together with the circumstances that there was a, how should I put it, a second isolation of the spores, apparently from the keyboard and possibly from the nasal passages of a second individual, all are very difficult to explain on the basis of any natural exposure.
Do you have a sense at this point of how the anthrax might have been introduced into the offices of American media in Florida?
No, I don't. I think there are a number of possibilities and several ways of attempting to distinguish between them. But I think until we have that information, it would be difficult to do this.
What are the likely means for this kind of introduction of the disease?
Well, one way would be to spray it as a fine aerosol. This is not easy to do, but it's conceivable that that's what happened, particularly if this really is inhalation anthrax. From what I've read, and so far one must point out, at least I have had no real scientific communications about it, but from what I have read, the evidence strongly suggests that it was inhalation anthrax, but I don't have all the information that would prove that for sure. I've heard that there's no lesion on the was found on the skin of Mr. Spencer, but it could be that only at autopsy will one be able to find out, and maybe not even then for sure, what was the route of entry. But let's assume it was inhalation. That would suggest that somehow there was a spray that was created and that he inhaled it. But if it was found on the typewriter or on the keyboard, then one would hope that in addition to just swiping it off, that one would have looked with a microscope to see what kind of particles, because once you smear it off, perhaps those particles would be distorted.
In the investigation, that is.
Yeah. And then you would want to look at the DNA sequences of the different isolates to make sure that they're the same, although the presumption is they would all be the same. But there's a lot that can be done if proper things are attempted to find out maybe how this happened.
Professor Messelson, at this point, the only comforting thing, and it's not comforting for the people involved, but is that the scale of this is so small. It seems so isolated.
It seems very small, and even the second case is not really a case of disease, so far as we're told. It's rather a case of isolating something from a man's nose.
Do we need to worry about a larger scale introduction of anthrax into populations, or is that imposingly difficult?
Well, I don't think it depends. If a state... There are several governments that have developed anthrax as a weapon in the past. We did, even during World War II, on a very large scale. President Nixon totally renounced biological warfare in 1969. The Soviets did anthrax. The British did. Great states with access to many scientists and many facilities have indeed learned how to do this. I don't think that individuals could learn how to do it very easily. But if they had information from the program of a nation that had done it, of course, then they would know what to do.
And would large-scale introduction require some kind of weaponry, a bomb or...
Really, by large scale, you mean what?
Well, you define it, but something larger than one office building.
Well, it would require, first of all, knowing how to grow it so that you could get a fine aerosol out of the spores. Mm-hmm. That's no easy thing to do. There are a number of technical reasons why I say that. I won't go into them. Mm-hmm. Then once you get it grown in the right way, you have to harvest it in the right way, you have to mill it in the right way, you have to treat it in the right way, and then And these things are all very complex. And then you might have a pottery material that could be dispersed as an aerosol. Less efficient, but still it was the way that we had planned to go when we had a program in World War II way back.
And yet, in spite of...
You could spray it as a liquid, a suspension of spores in liquid. That's much less efficient, but it still could be quite dangerous.
In spite of all these difficulties, it appears now that at a very small scale, it may have happened. Why can't we just vaccinate the American population against anthrax, Professor Meselson?
Well, any program to vaccinate everybody, first of all, has drawbacks of its own because many vaccines have harmful effects on people who may have be immunocompromised and so on. But then you have to take into account that there are many agents that could conceivably be used in an evil way. And so in the process of vaccinating the American public, the whole world would know that the American public had been vaccinated against one agent, namely anthrax.
And not another.
And not another. The NATO threat list, for example, has about 30 different agents on it, and some of them are just categories of agents. So I think unless you really knew that that was likely to be the main threat, I don't think there's anybody thinking of vaccinating the entire American public. Mm-hmm. One should look, I think, for generic protections and protections that are sustainable. And there are some possibilities there.
Such as?
Well, it should be coupled with something which has health benefits anyway. And what I have in mind here is not a cure-all, but many people live in places where the air is polluted. And because of that, there are higher rates of bronchitis and emphysema and other respiratory illness. And in those buildings, large apartment houses, large office buildings, it would be possible, at not great expense, to install filters that would have a positive health benefit. Perhaps even life insurance companies might lower one's premium slightly.
And might filter out anthrax or other agents as well.
That would be generic. You could filter out all agents. Now, this doesn't offer protection against something released inside a building, but it does offer protection against, first of all, air pollution, which is a problem, a health problem, and against anything released on a large scale, say, to attempting to cover more than one building.
It sounds like
I'm
this.
I'm not saying this is a cure-all, but it is something to keep in mind.
It sounds like this conversation is just getting started. Matthew Meselson is a professor of biology at Harvard University. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Meselson.
Thank you.
Who will pay for the war on terrorism? That's our question this hour. In the Gulf War, it was Japan and Saudi Arabia that picked up the huge tab. But this time, it now appears that the United States will have to dig deep into its own pockets at the same time it's trying to dig out of an economic downturn. The impact on the federal budget will be heavy, with no sacred cows. Social Security, even Medicare funds may be tapped. And that could be just the beginning. What kind of social programs are you willing to sacrifice to pay for the war on terrorism? And for how long? What do you think is the best way to finance this war? Join the conversation. The number to call is 1-800-423-8245. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from New York is Greg Ipp, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening, Mr. Ipp.
Hi, how are you?
Great. It's good to have you with us. And sitting in tonight for our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, is Robert Reich. Robert Reich is former Secretary of Labor in the first Clinton administration and is now a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University. Welcome, Robert Reich.
Thank you, Tom.
Let me correct that phone number. It's 1-800-423-8255. Greg Ipp, let me turn first to you. There will be a budgeted price for this war on terrorism, but I wanted to ask you first about the economic price that we may already be paying and that we may continue to pay. How is the events of the last month and the war on terrorism ensuing impacting or the economy?
Well, you know, it used to be an old rule of economic historians that wars often turned out to be very stimulative for the economy because the government would go out and buy tremendous quantities of ammunition and equipment like tanks and airplanes and so on. So the first difference now is that, first of all, this is on a much smaller scale. I mean, the numbers being bandied about would suggest that we're going to be probably spending an additional $40 billion a year on defense and national security needs. That's of an overall fiscal stimulus, a temporary fiscal fiscal stimulus of the $100 billion range. That $40 billion is about 0.4% of GDP, which compares to the roughly 1% of GDP increase in defense spending that we saw in the peak years of the Vietnam War or the Reagan buildup. So first thing is that the dollars are not as large historically as they have been in previous conflict periods. But more important is that this conflict is having severe negative consequences throughout the rest of the private economy, which will almost certainly more than swamp that stimulative impact. And I'm speaking, first of all, of the confidence effect. We know that people feel less safe and more worried about their security and about their jobs in the wake of these attacks. We know they were worried already, even before that happened, because the economy was so weak. And secondly, the need to respond to this unique form of war is imposing all sorts of costs, many of them very difficult to detect, on businesses, and they can be very subtle. For example, hiring extra security guards when you might have wanted, for example, to hire computer programmers that would make your product better or cheaper, or extra costs for getting your stuff over the border, or more delays in terms of transportation, longer delays at airports, at seaports, and so on. These things, they all add costs and inefficiencies to the whole production process, and that will end up costing us.
Robert Reich, are these different kinds of costs, economic costs, that we're incurring in this effort from previous wartime periods?
Yes, very much so. The government spending as a percentage of gross domestic product peaked at almost 44% in the Second World War. That was a huge, huge expenditure. Here, as Greg Ipp suggests, we're talking about maybe 0.4% of the national product. In terms of direct outlays, again, very, very tiny. But I want to go back to something that Mr. Ipp was talking about a moment ago, consumer confidence. Mm-hmm. That is the big issue. Consumer confidence was slipping even before September 11th, and obviously people are worried about their jobs, they're worried about the future, they're deep in debt, they're not going to go out into the stores as readily as they did last year. And after September 11th, obviously, all of that uncertainty becomes magnified.
Greg Ipp at the Wall Street Journal, you have a lot of people paying attention to this. What is your sense of consumer confidence at this point? How are consumers bearing up under the headlines and drumbeat of war and trouble?
Actually, I think that perhaps they may be showing more resilience than we perhaps gave them credit for in the immediate week afterwards. We've seen quite a few various surveys coming out, and some of them have shown that confidence has, in fact, sort of hung in around the pre-attack levels, which I hasten to add were not terribly strong in the first place. And although some skeptics would argue that this is what you would expect from a rally around the flag effect, and that then they would point out that you cannot spend patriotism, it may also be the case that people are trying very hard to get back to their normal lives. And we should remember that there's been a tremendous response in terms of our economic policymakers to this, and I'm thinking primarily the Federal Reserve, which has cut interest rates by a full percentage point. And that has begun to ripple through to the types of interest rates that most of us pay. And as a result, you've now been able to buy cars from the big three for 0% financing for 3 years. Mortgage rates have fallen to their lowest level since 1998. And that's providing a very important boost to the housing and the automobile markets. I think that one interesting difference between this sort of wartime economy, if you will, and some previous periods goes to a point that Professor Reich actually made in a very interesting article in the Washington Post some weeks ago, is that in previous wars, people were asked to tighten their belt and save more money so that more resources could be spared for the wartime effort. Here, this has happened at a point when we have tremendous spare capacity in our industrial sector. And the greater concern really is to get people continuing to spend. And that is definitely an interesting and important difference from some of these previous periods we've had.
Greg Ipp, thanks very much for joining us this evening. Greg Ipp reports on economic issues for the Wall Street Journal. Robert Reich, he's citing your own view there that this is different.
Well, this is different in a variety of ways. Again, patriotism means this time around apparently spending rather than refraining from spending. But also there is this odd effect. Since September 11th, a lot of people have been saying, and certainly have said to me personally, you know, I'm reordering my priorities. I'm not going to work quite as hard. I'm not going to spend quite as much. Accumulating all this stuff is just not as important. I've got to think differently about my life. Now, that is great for individuals to do, but it does raise a very profound and fundamental question about what our economy is all about. If everybody did that, our economy would collapse.
We're facing a big price tag for a war, and it may express itself in many, many ways, perhaps in your own personal life, certainly at the federal budget level. We're going to be talking about that this hour, and we welcome your calls. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online, log on at WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this new war and how we're going to pay for it. How to stabilize the economy and consumer confidence in a new kind of wartime. What social programs are you willing to throw into the fire to keep the war effort burning bright? Are you putting money under the mattress or reinvesting in stocks? Should the president get a blank check? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at WBUR.org. Our special news analyst, Robert Reich, is here in the studio sitting in tonight for Jack Beatty, and we want to hear from you. I'd like to now bring in James Galbraith to our conversation. James Galbraith is professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas at Austin and is a former executive director of the Joint Economic Committee for the U.S. Congress. He joins us from Austin, Texas. Good evening, Professor Galbraith.
Good evening.
We're looking at what the price of this war might be and how we're going to pay it. We look at back at the Vietnam War, it cost $572 billion in current dollars. Gulf War cost was $80 billion paid by Saudi Arabia and Japan. Is it possible to have any sense at this point with the president and his top officials talking about a long, long war, any sense of how much this war might cost?
So far, the indications are that it will not cost very much in terms of dollars or material resources at the level at which it's currently being fought.
And why is that?
Because we're conducting a very limited air operations by historical standards, and to the extent that we will get in later into ground operations, they will also be very limited. They will be substantially covered out of the operating budget of the military in any event, and any excess. I'm not going to say that the $40 billion that has been allocated so far, it's already being discussed, is going to be the sum total of it. But that is a reasonable ballpark figure mm-hmm. for the kind of measures that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. These are not significant in macroeconomic terms. So I think that point is a very important one for people to realize. At the same time, what it implies is that it's, I think, very, very misleading and I think rather frightening people to discuss about to raise the question of a need to cut social programs or to cut the activities of government, the services that government provides.
But Professor Galbraith,
in some sense, to pay for these activities.
But President Bush himself has raised the possibility of going into Social Security funds and maybe more than that.
Going into Social Security funds does not in any way apply a need to reduce Social Security benefits. That's an accounting mechanism in the federal budget. The two things are absolutely unconnected.
These are exactly the issues you want to sort out this evening.
Now, this is very important because what we face here really is a need to maintain the support of the American population in a national endeavor, which may be going on for quite a long period of time, as the administration has made clear. It becomes, under those conditions, the responsibility of the government, of the administration, to ensure that, let's say, American working families have the opportunity to work, that jobs are available.
Mm-hmm.
And if those jobs are not going to be provided in the ordinary course of events by a private sector, which may in any event, which has already been contracting and may be contracting more rapidly as a result of the attacks on September 11th, then it becomes a responsibility of public policy to take action to make sure that the economy continues to provide jobs to working Americans.
Mm.
That's a very important point to realize because that may well involve activity on a much larger scale than we have been discussing and anybody has been discussing so far.
To keep the economy going. So we see two tracks emerging here. One is the direct costs of this campaign, however it evolves. The other is the cost to the economy, a new kind of war and maybe new kinds of costs to the economy. Robert Reich?
Well, as Jamie Galbraith is saying, the direct costs, budgetary costs, are very, very small, and we should not, absolutely should not, talk about cutting social programs in order to pay for war. We're not nearly there. There's no capacity problem in the country. In fact, if anything, we have too much capacity given the total amount of demand. We ought to be spending more, both individually, and that's hard for a lot of people who are deep in debt, but certainly government at this time should be spending more, taxing less. The real costs we're talking about have to do with the psychology of consumers and also investors who are a little spooked right now, and not surprisingly spooked. Just one thing I want to bring up. Apparently, on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, there are right now a lot of programs being slashed. The child welfare bill that was going to be funded, about $300 million, yesterday, the particular congressional committee in charge said no, they won't do it because, quote, this is from the chairman of the committee, the president has said, we are at war. The national security and budget implications of that fact change everything, and any new spending is just not permissible. That kind of logic, and I'd love to hear Jamie, Professor Galbraith talk about that, that kind of logic is exactly backwards.
You want the spending to go on, James.
Well, not only do we want it because social programs of like this are very important, but also we are now in a situation where the economy is slowing. If anything, government needs to be spending more.
James Galbraith, how does this add up? We know that politics quickly come into play on Capitol Hill, but we've heard that a big spending bill is on its way, perhaps coming out in the next week, and yet you hear Robert Reich quoting the chairman of the committee who wants to cut spending on children.
I think people have not entirely sorted out what they think and what they ought to be thinking about these problems. But we are now, as I said, in a national endeavor, and that means that everybody ought to have a role to play. In an economy, if you can imagine it, let's say, in which we are being told, let's say 2 years from now, to put up with, let's say, 10 or 12 or 14% unemployment, that might be an extreme figure, but just imagine, and still told that this is necessary, a necessary sacrifice for a war effort which is dragging on without visible result, you can easily see the mood of the country becoming very ugly and very unwilling to lend any additional confidence to the national leadership.
That would be a heavy cost indeed. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We have callers who are stacking up and want to join the conversation. Let's bring them in. Herb is calling from Cary, North Carolina. Welcome, Herb. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call.
Good to have you. What's your question or point, Herb?
My point was that as I listened to the conversation here.
Yes, we hear you.
Retirement in a few years. I've planned very carefully for it, and I've seen it evaporate away this year with the downturn in the economy. And it really frightens me to think of the inflation that's going to be in for out there in the future as we pay off this deficit spending.
So we missed part of your comment, but I take it you're expecting deficit spending to grow out of this war effort.
Deficit spending will be compounded by the war effort. We're already in the sluggish economy, which is pushing us deeper and deeper into deficit spending.
Herb, thanks for your call. Robert Reich, Herb is anticipating deficit spending, and he's worried about the impact of that on his retirement savings, and I'm sure other people are worried about it on their savings for their children's education, whatever it may be. How should we think about this in national terms as it relates to personal lives?
Well, undoubtedly, over the longer term, we are both, in terms of the federal government and also as individuals, going to have to save more. The baby boomers are a huge tidal wave heading for the shores of retirement in about 10 or 15 years. But the way we avoid inflation way out there is to cut the $1.3 trillion tax cut that has already been enacted, cut that in the out years, Tom. And this is something, again, I think it's very important for people to understand right now. And Herb, the caller, should understand, right now we ought to be spending more and taxing less. The economy needs that extra stimulus. Over the longer term, the way we pay for that is to cut and eliminate some of those out-year tax cuts.
Mm-hmm. That have recently been passed on President Bush's sponsorship.
Absolutely. Cancel them in the out years, particularly for people who are very wealthy. There's no reason that they should necessarily get a tax cut when we are facing war, when we have an economy that is sluggish right now, and we need to stimulate it right now.
James Galbraith, do you see any chance of that happening, of some of those Bush-sponsored tax cuts being pulled back?
Well, I would be certainly in favor of revisiting the tax bill that was passed earlier this year. I think that's a good idea. But I agree with Bob that the immediate priority is to maintain this enormously powerful machine of our economy. And I think the caller should be aware that the accounting devices, whether it's done by government spending or by private spending, are really secondary in this phenomenon. It is the case that over the past 4 or 5 years, and this goes back to the previous administration, the economy was fueled by an enormous excess of private spending over private incomes. Mm-hmm. That could not, in the nature of things, continue forever. We saw the first ending of it with the collapse of the tech sector already beginning in April of 2000. So at some point, the government has to step up to the plate and help to restore the financial position of private households, including our caller's household, I would imagine, providing incomes in excess of its and providing spending in excess of its taxes.
And revving
that
up
is simply
the
a necessary step. It's not necessarily – I would not say revving up. I, in fact, very much dislike the use of this term stimulus, which seems to me
it's
to have
everywhere.
A fundamentally misleading context. What we should be talking about here is to the need to stabilize our economy, which has been slipping for – well over a year. We need to stabilize it at a high level of functioning, and we need to take all of those measures that are necessary in order to achieve that purpose.
We're at 1-800-423-8255 talking about the costs of the new war we're entering. How do you see the cost of this war impacting the nation, impacting you? Join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Duke is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Duke. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing, folks?
We're well.
Listen, we got a problem here. Our city's about to file for bankruptcy shortly.
Is that Buffalo, Duke? Are you talking about Buffalo, New York?
Yes. The city is broke. The state is broke. The federal government has no more money, yet the federal government's looking to pay $350 million refugees for food and everything, and they can't take care of us here in Western New York. My problem is this now. We got a lot of old folks here living here, and now they're saying something about dipping into the Social Security. You got a lot of scared people here, and I can't see it going there either. I wish somebody would worry about here in Western New York, yet overseas also, but find other funds because you got a lot of people here that are really scared.
Thanks for your call, Duke. James Galbraith, what about this? I think people have heard that we're going to use Social Security funds, and that automatically makes them worried about whether or not it's going to be there for them when they come to retirement age.
The caller, however, raised a tremendously important point, which really cannot be overstressed, and that is that the next wave of slowdown in our economy is likely to come from states and localities and cities cutting their budgets. And he referred to the very dire fiscal condition of Buffalo, New York. But New York City, of course, announced today that it had $1 billion shortfall just from the September 11th attacks. Many other parts of the country's state sales taxes are falling, and states are responding to that by cutting their capital budgets and by not funding regular expenditures that they would ordinarily fund. This should be stopped. The single most important stabilizing action that the federal government could take would be to go out onto the markets and to borrow enough money to stabilize the budgets of states and localities, and even to permit them to offer a tax holiday on sales and property taxes to their local citizens and ratepayers. That would have an enormous effect on confidence, on household balance sheets, and on preventing a spiraling downward of the economy as a whole as a result of cutbacks at these lower levels of government. So I think that point that the caller made is absolutely of the greatest importance.
But Robert Reich, I don't want to let the Social Security issue go because people are worried about it. They hear that we're going to dip into those funds potentially to cover some of these costs. Why won't that have an impact down the road when people are ready to retire?
Because the Social Security Trust Fund, Tom, was an accounting fiction created 18 months ago. It has absolutely no reality. The issue fundamentally, and it has to do with the future of Buffalo, the future of the ability of this country to spend in 15 years versus right now, what is the debt level of the federal government as a proportion of the national economy, and what can we afford? Professor Galbraith is exactly right. Right now, the federal government can do something that Buffalo cannot do. The federal government can go deeper into debt, can bail out places like New York and Buffalo, and having the federal government go deeper into debt is perfectly appropriate, in fact, desirable right now. The federal debt, as a proportion of the national economy, is far below what it was, let's say, in 1997. It's 38%. That may sound like a lot, but it is very relatively small. We can go deeper into debt to stimulate the economy. James Galbraith doesn't like the word stimulation. Stabilize the economy, whatever you want. But we can also and must bail out cities and states and make sure that there is adequate spending.
We're talking about the cost of this new war on terrorism, who's going to bear them, how they may impact you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Judy is on the line. Welcome, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm part of a household where, that has suffered layoffs. And ever since I've been hearing about we're supposed to go out and continue spending money like we did before, I wonder where we're supposed to get the money from. And lots of people have suffered layoffs. And that's one thing, and I'm really glad to hear this program because the two economists are both saying things that I want someone to say who's in a powerful position besides me. Secondly, so that's just one thing that seems to rub me the wrong way, and it seems to be a real disconnect.
Okay.
And the second is this talk about government intervening really makes me feel good because my husband's a computer programmer, and I don't understand how he can get a job in the computer industry anymore unless there's something governmental behind it. You know,
because sure.
Or the government helps a venture capitalist or somebody to give more money or give them tax breaks or whatever the heck they have to do.
Judy, we've got your point, and thanks for your call. Robert Reich, you hear that there are layoffs in that household, and it's not the only one. There have been many tens of thousands laid off recently. How will this government spending that you're proposing filter down to that level? And can Judy's household feel confidence that the impact of this war, another way of saying its cost, won't keep her family economically disadvantaged?
But again, Judy, I don't know, obviously, and can't presume to know the specifics of your family situation, but a lot of people are understandably concerned about the possibility that they may lose their jobs, and they are already deeply in debt. We have a 70-year low in terms of national savings. One thing the federal government can do, apart from simply asking companies not to lay people off, which, after all, if you're concerned about patriotism, that might be an appropriate patriotic request, would be to cut payroll taxes. Now, 80% of Americans pay more in payroll taxes than they do in income taxes. So a payroll tax cut that could go into effect tomorrow, just to lower the withholding for 12 calendar months at least, that would put money into people's pockets and make people feel a little bit more, just a little bit more secure, and also expand unemployment insurance. Fewer than 40% of families that lose jobs are now covered by unemployment insurance.
James Galbraith, do you see a chance of either of those things happening, lower payroll taxes or expanded unemployment insurance?
They're both very good ideas, and they've both been under discussion. There's no reason why these things cannot happen. I don't think these should be considered to be political or partisan issues at this stage. We are really all talking about what is necessary to maintain our national stability and our national sense of solidarity for what may be quite a very long and difficult period. Let me go on and just in that vein make a comment back on the issue of Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me what people need to realize is that if we do, as we will, tap into the so-called Social Security trust fund, the lockbox, whatever you want to call it, we will then be incurring a very solemn moral commitment not to let that have any effect on the benefit levels that today's retirees or future retirees experience. Mm-hmm. So we are, in some sense, by bringing those things into this effort, I think incurring a very solemn obligation not to play politics with them later on.
James Galbraith,
to ensure that people do in fact receive the Social Security benefits that they're entitled to.
We have to take a quick break right here. You can hear what's on the table. We're saying Social Security won't be affected, and yet James Galbraith is saying it comes with an obligation. Obligations have to be supported. We want to hear from you. Where is the cost of this war on terrorism going to fall? And will it fall now or years from now? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the cost of the war on terrorism and who's going to bear it. We're talking this hour with Professor James Galbraith and tonight's special coverage guest news analyst Robert Reich. How will the federal government finance the fight against terrorism? What impact might it have in your house? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert Reich, I want to turn our conversation, if we could, to the impact on the larger economy of the situation we're in, where suddenly we don't have that high-speed, fluid, frictionless economy that was so exciting during the 1990s that was already slowing down. Now we have security checkpoints. We have industries as callers, and James Galbraith were pointing out having to implement new security measures. We have, it seems like, lots of sand thrown in the gears of that frictionless economy that we were all about embracing. What's the cost of that?
Very difficult to calculate, Tom, but undoubtedly that is one of the biggest costs of this post-terrorist era. If we do slow down, that may be good for our hearts, but it's going to be bad for our economy. If it takes longer to get into buildings, longer to get through airline checkpoints, if materials cannot go across borders nearly as rapidly or as quickly as before, in other words, if at every critical juncture there is some sort of a check to make sure that there is not a terrorist or a bomb or whatever, you can imagine the entire American economy simply slowing down, becoming less flexible, and losing that buoyancy, that seamless buoyancy that was the essence of what made it successful in the 1990s.
It certainly was, and now you see venture capital drying up, and we don't know what's happening with entrepreneurship, but everything just seems more sluggish. James Galbraith, can we get past that, or is this a permanent tax that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have put on the American economy?
I think we can certainly get past it. First of all, I don't think the 1990s were, what they were cracked up to be at the time. We, for example, laid down 50 times as much fiber optic cable in the last part of the last decade than we're actually using or have any likelihood of using. So there were a great many inefficiencies in that frictionless economy to which you refer.
So some of the new sobriety may actually be helpful here.
It certainly might, and it particularly if we use our resources now to do some things that we actually need, like, for example, rebuild and expand our schools. But there are also, just talking about these security issues, many things that we can do once we catch our breath and think a little bit more carefully that will make these matters appear much less burdensome than they do right now.
That's a comforting thought.
I flew out of Logan. A specific example. I flew out of Logan the Sunday a couple of weeks ago, just not long after it reopened. And it was there was an enormous crowd in the airport.
James Galbraith, I want to get one more call in here before the end of our time. Laura's calling from Cary, North Carolina. Welcome, Laura.
Hi. Pleased to be able to ask you this question tonight. It seems to me that we have two things going on here. We have a failure of intelligence, not only in our own country, but from the perspective of the propaganda in Afghanistan. And we also have a huge we have a problem with trying to correlate all the information that has been gathered by the intelligence community. There's been a huge amount of information that's been gathered that they have not been able to put together to predict things like the events of September 11th.
What's your link to the economy or cost of the war, Laura?
Well, at the same time, we have a huge number of computer professionals who are out of work. So whereas in the past all of our wars have been wars of hardware, it could be that this war in the long term will be a war of information. And the computer professionals will have a great deal of impact on our success.
This is an interesting angle, Laura. Let me put it to Robert Reich. Laura's suggesting that this war effort may, in fact, pull in the kind of information professionals who were being thrown out of work in the late 90s. Do you see that possibility?
Well, it's certainly possible. Again, unemployment is creeping upward, Laura. Computer professionals, most of them are still obviously employed. But at some point, if the economy slows way down, and we hope it doesn't, the government may have to be an employer of last resort. And among the people it may very well employ, as it did in the Second World War, as it did in Vietnam, are a lot of people who have computer skills.
James Galbraith, we're reaching the end of our time. Final thoughts on how this may ripple through the economy and the cost?
An economic dimension to the conduct of the war itself. Mm-hmm. I think this will not be a war conducted by intelligence officers, whether electronic or otherwise. It's a war that will be conducted largely by the goodwill of our allies in places like Pakistan and Egypt and other parts of the world, where we will be relying on our friends to find the bad guys and turn them in. And in order to guarantee that we have friends, we really will have to rethink the way we finance global development. We will have to be there. We'll have to give credible assurances that we will be there for the Pakistanis when this is over. That is something which is going to force us to rethink the way the global financial system is organized. It's a big topic, but it's one that should not be left off the agenda even at this early stage.
An important one. And in the few seconds we have left, Robert Reich, foreign aid, does it stimulate our economy, or is it simply a drain, but one that we have to spend to bring some stability in the world?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tom. In the years after the Second World War, when we were facing the Soviet menace, we talked about trade, not aid. We talked about expanding the liberal economic sphere, making sure that more nations were brought into American prosperity, and we fought off the Soviet threat that way. Maybe, and this is something that Jamie Galbraith may be suggesting as well, in this post-terrorist era, when we have a new kind of enemy, we've got to think about a global economic set of policies that spread prosperity.
I want to thank you, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And thank you, James Galbraith, for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
James Galbraith is a professor of public affairs and government at the University of Texas at Austin. He joined us from Austin, Texas. Robert Reich, sitting in for our special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, is the founder and national editor of The American Prospect and a professor at Brandeis University. You can continue this conversation about the cost of the war and where it may fall online. Click on WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in the form of radio diaries. Emily XYZ is a poet and performance artist who has lived in and loved New York City for 20 years. She was in Chicago when the attacks occurred, but returned a few days later to a more somber, silent, and kinder city than she had ever known.
In Hinduism, there is such a thing as sacred ash, which is striped across the foreheads of Brahmins and spiritual seekers. In Catholicism also, there is sacred ash, which comes in the form of a little cross drawn on your forehead by a priest's thumb on Ash Wednesday. They used to say, "Remember, man, that thou art dust, and into dust thou shalt return." But at some point it was decided this was too heavy a message, and so they changed it to a more innocuous blessing. There is secular ash, too, like what remains in the barbecue grill after a summer cookout, or what's left after leaf piles burn in the fall, in the few towns where this is still allowed. And then there is the ash that never should have been, that everyone wishes would reverse pulverize, reorganize its particles, and become again the thing it once was. This is the category of ash into which the World Trade Center falls. It is absolutely stunning, shocking. There's no way to describe it. I couldn't see much, but what I could see was appalling. The very edge of a huge mountain of rubble. Part of the shell of the South Tower still standing, but twisted, wrong, impossible. And the smoke, endlessly smoking. It is impossible to accept that this horrible mess used to be the sleek, gigantic World Trade Center, that a week ago they stood right there, corrugated ribbons of silver and light, towering over the entire neighborhood, marking the south end of Manhattan, and now nothing. Just a sickening smell, and cops and firemen all over the place looking like combat veterans. I wish they would put up a new building exactly the same as the old, two towers, 110 floors each. But I wish these ones would be made of rose and orange and lavender and blue steel and gold surface glass to intensify the sunset even more. That's how I imagine the towers in heaven. I wonder if the Japanese architect who designed the Trade Center is still alive, and how it feels to have created a huge, beautiful, iconic thing like that, and then see it destroyed in 2 hours' time. At Park Row and Ann Street, right across from City Hall, one of the most ominous views, Old St. Paul's Chapel, completely undamaged. Behind that, the Woolworth Building, once the world's tallest, now seeming quite tall again, but dark, its pale green tower invisible in the night sky. No electricity in this part of town, save that provided by huge generators to power big work lights. And behind the Woolworth Building, the constant, swirling, steamy, billowing white smoke, lit up by the work lights, like a movie running against the blue-black sky. At Church and Chambers, another view of smoke and light, only this time you really smell the smoke. Unpleasant, wood, plastic, electrical, chemical. There is a Buddha sitting and singing with tears running down his face. In front of him, three people face the mountain of ash and pray, hands folded, bow from waist, hands to the ground, kneel, forehead to the ground, turn palms up, stand, bring hands to prayer, repeat the whole thing. Then the teacher starts to laugh. The bowing continues. Finally, after maybe 15 minutes, they took a pause and I asked what they were doing. One of them, a Chinese woman, told me they were Buddhists and that they were bowing to the dead and praying they would go to heaven, which I guess is what she figured a Westerner would understand. She said they bow 108 times. They got ready to start again, and I asked if I could join them, and she said yes. It was the one thing I've done this whole time that seemed worthwhile, that actually felt like a contribution. It felt like we were reaching out to the people who died and to the towers themselves and finally doing something for them, giving them comfort, assuring them that we know what happened and we remember them with love and sending them on their way. How long have I lived here and loved this place, yet never once touched my face to a New York City street? What we need is a real prayer for the dead. Not a movie theme, not We Will Survive, but a resonant old ritual that gives form and voice to great pain. The trash basket was in front of me, the recycling truck came by, the police or firefighters were talking, the pedestrians were walking, trucks were allowed through the barrier, the smoke billowed on, and we stood up, hands in prayer, bowed, knelt down, touched our foreheads to the ashy sidewalk, stood up again and again and again, bowing to the smoke in the air and the ash on the ground that is so many people, so many things, so many events and memories, bowing, standing, taking the ash on our hands and foreheads and making it sacred, bowing, standing, mourning, accepting, releasing. My yoga school put a special message on their website calling for compassion for everybody and everything, not just the victims, but the terrorists, too. Not just the victims of this violence, but of violence everywhere. Not just these human victims, but all animals, too. The yoga position, I know, is basically that no life is separate from any other. So to speak of terrorists or victims, Arabs or Americans, humans or animals, is to impose a separation that does not exist in reality. But what I can't get past is the image, which was not an image, but a thing that really happened, of an airplane flying straight at my office window. This is what happened, and the people inside both the buildings and the planes saw it coming. They heard it, they saw it, and they knew the plane was headed at them, and they knew that within a few seconds they would be dead. All my philosophy, all my ideas of what is and what should be, collapse like a stack of empty boxes when I consider this, which really happened for more than a minute or two. These people not only knew they were about to die, some of them probably even realized in the last moments of their existence what exactly was going on. Then they were atomized by a force I can't even conceive of. Here, my imagining stops, along with my philosophy. I am not an enlightened being. I am a human being who practices yoga and tries to live right. But I haven't transcended any of the limits of my condition. And what I think are firm beliefs shred like a silk blouse when I am confronted with the thought of imminent, gigantic, roaring, annihilating chaos coming out of a clear blue sky on a fine September morning. So I don't know about this having compassion for the hijackers thing. I'm just not that good yet. I can find a certain understanding. Maybe it takes the same kind of inhuman nerve to pilot yourself into kingdom come as it does to drag your unwilling mind into enlightenment. Heroism and monstrosity standing side by side on opposite sides of the line, a line drawn in the ash.
New York-based poet and performance artist, Emily XYZ. We'd like to hear from you and your stories. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can learn about the history of Afghanistan and its neighbors online. Interactive maps, photographs, and more are available on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.